This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. 2 years ago, the Supreme Court ruled for the first time that the Second Amendment, the right to bear arms, gives individuals the right to own a handgun. Today, the court began what looks to be a long process of deciding where to draw the line on gun rights. The 2008 ruling struck down the handgun ban in the District of Columbia, which comes under federal law. So the first issue is whether that decision extends to cities and states, specifically to the city of Chicago and its suburb, Oak Park, Illinois. And if an outright ban is unconstitutional, does that allow handguns just in a home or just in a business? Would most people be allowed to carry concealed handguns in their cars or on the street? Where do you draw the line? Give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. Later in the program, drawing a new poverty line, the Undersecretary of Commerce on measurements that include more than just income, but first, handguns and Chicago. David Savage covers the Supreme Court for the Los Angeles Times and the Chicago Tribune. He often joins us to discuss cases before the court. He joins us now here in Studio 3A. David, always nice to have you on the program.
Hi, Neil.
Now, 2 years ago, the court struck down the D.C. ban by a vote of 5-4. Any reason to believe that that arithmetic has changed?
No, it looked like exactly the same lineup in this case. Five justices in the majority to say, we really meant it. The Second Amendment creates an individual right, and it not only limits federal laws, it limits state and local laws. That certainly seemed to be the tenor of it.
And this is not just the Second Amendment, but the 14th Amendment to the Constitution as well.
Yes, there's a simple conclusion and a lot of long history to get there. Most people, I think most ordinary Americans would not know that for most of American history, the Bill of Rights was quite limited. It limited only the federal government. And the Supreme Court said throughout the 19th century that the rights like freedom of speech and including the right to bear arms were only limitations on the federal government. In the 20th century, they incorporated those rights into the liberty in the 14th Amendment. Therefore, states, you have a right to freedom of speech from state laws, local laws, and federal laws. There weren't many Second Amendment cases, so they never answered this basic question that even if the Second Amendment protects an individual right, does it apply to state and local governments? And that was the issue today.
So can we expect clarity this time around that this is going to settle all the arguments about who has the right to own handguns?
No. Clarity in the sense that they are going to say, I'm pretty sure, that it applies to state and local laws, that the Chicago handgun ordinance is unconstitutional because it's a total ban, but not clarity in the sense of how far does the Second Amendment go? What is this right really? Because John Roberts said halfway through the argument, we haven't said anything about the content of the Second Amendment, and we really don't need to do it here. We just need to say it extends to Chicago, and we'll tell you down the road what it really means.
So this means there are going to be a lot of arguments over, well, all right, presuming they rule the way you think they're going to rule, that an outright ban on handguns is unconstitutional. Does that mean that that localities can then restrict, well, where you can keep it, what kinds of guns, that sort of thing?
Yes, that's absolutely right. I think the big importance of this decision, it's going to open the door to lawsuits all around the country and federal court of people objecting to state and local restrictions on handguns, and it's going to take a while to work out, you know, what this right really entails.
And indeed, after the ruling that referred to the District of Columbia 2 years ago, there's now a suit brought by the same people saying not just own a handgun, but have the right to what's called concealed carry, to carry a weapon on the streets.
Yes, Justice Scalia said in that opinion that we're going to interpret the Second Amendment based on what it meant in history. And it meant in history a right to possess and carry a weapon in cases of confrontation. And he also talked about the right to self-defense. So that sounds like something more than just a gun at home.
So these are essentially what we're talking about is two big ideas on what's the best way to protect the citizenry, an armed citizenry that can respond to its own in its own self-defense, or is it a better idea for the police to do that?
Yes, and that's the division. It sure looks like it's 5-4 in favor of there is a right to have a gun. And the fact that there's police on the street, that doesn't cancel the idea that that individuals have a right to have a gun for self-defense.
And isn't this, you would think that some of the more conservative justices would say, wait a minute, don't the states have rights here? States' rights? Haven't we heard that argument from people like Antonin Scalia?
This is a game where sort of the musical chairs where everybody is reversed. The liberals talk about deferring to state and local governments. We don't want federal judges to make all these decisions. Shouldn't we let city
localities know their own situations best?
Correct. And the conservatives say, wait a minute, the Constitution has individual rights, and it doesn't matter what state and localities think. Those rights are there in the Constitution, and they mean something.
Well, we're going to hear from attorneys who have been arguing on both sides. We also want to hear from you. Where do we draw the line on handguns? 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. Why don't we begin with Mark? And Mark joins us from Tallahassee.
Hi there.
Hi, go ahead, Mark.
Hi, I just had 4 points to make.
Four. Why don't you try one or two?
One or two. Okay, well, I'll try to stick with one or two. I have my concealed carry permit, and I think that drawing the line at state or local is absurd. I think that the founding fathers are very clear on the right to bear arms, and I don't think it should be limited to federal law or state or even local, and I think even Wyatt Earp would have been violating the U.S. Constitution. As
if I remember the Wyatt Earp case correctly, at Tombstone you had to check your six gun on the way into town.
Right, right, exactly right, and I think that's even a violation. Secondly, I think that even my right to carry onto a college campus, for example, I think that's a violation, and I don't believe that shootings like the Virginia Tech shooting would occur, or at least would be less violent, or at least more short-lived, if more students were, you know, had the right to carry and defend themselves.
And David Savage, I just wanted to get back on that point. David Savage, that's an argument a lot of people have made. There shouldn't be restrictions if students had been carrying weapons in Virginia Tech or other such incidents. Those kinds of things might have been cut a great deal shorter than they were.
Yes, I think that's absolutely right. That's why I think this is going to be really interesting over the next decade to sort of for the courts to try to flesh out what this right means, because a lot of people think I would be safer if I could have a gun, and public places would be safer if some people were armed. But there's a whole lot of people on the other side who think I don't want to go to a college, or I don't want to go to a restaurant or bar where a lot of people have guns, that it would make it more dangerous, not safer.
You can't smoke in a bar.
In Virginia, though, you possibly may be able to bring your handgun to the bar.
Well, obviously, there are places that there are going to be restrictions, for example, on airplanes. They're not going to allow guns on airplanes.
And the Supreme Court justices are not going to allow guns in the courtroom, and neither are members of Congress. Everybody recognizes there are some places where a total ban on guns makes sense. Everybody is safer because there are no guns there.
And that's where we're talking about today. Where do you draw the line? Joining us here in Studio 3A is attorney Alan Gura, who represented the petitioners challenging the Chicago handgun ban. And he argued at the Supreme Court this morning. And thanks very much for being with us here in Studio 3A.
Thanks for having me.
And where do you draw the line?
Well, the line is going to be drawn in different places depending on which case we're talking about. The Supreme Court made very clear in Heller, and I hope it'll make clear again in
Heller was the case in the District Court.
That's right, in the Washington, D.C. case. And I hope the court will make clear again here in the case that was heard today that when the state is violating the right as it's been historically understood, that is, rights have certain contours and shapes and they include certain things, that when a state is actually literally violating something that people have come to expect as their right, then the state's going to be told by the federal courts, they cannot behave in that manner. Now, some cases are going to be more difficult and the history and the text run out and we have to engage in a process of construction and we have to engage that right in a meaningful way. And in those cases, the Second Amendment right should be treated the way that other fundamental enumerated rights are treated under the Constitution. The First Amendment, for example, is given a very, very heavy deal of protection.
Yet you can't shout fire in a crowded theater, as we all know.
Sure, and you can't shoot people for no reason, but you can definitely have a gun for self-defense.
At a college? In a courtroom?
Well, a courtroom is probably not going to be, I mean, that's sort of the classic place, a courtroom, an airplane. The Supreme Court in Heller talked about there being certain sensitive places where guns can be banned from, and we don't know what a sensitive place is. That's going to require some more litigation to flesh out. We can only surmise that a sensitive place is a place where the government has undertaken some kind of extra security measure. We have, for example, metal detectors in the courtroom. There's extra security, and there's a very sensitive governmental function going on there that, you know, it's okay, you can be deprived of your firearm rights while you're in that setting. Airplanes, same thing.
Right.
It's a small, self-contained area. You can't take a bottle of water into this sterile area of an airport anymore, much less a gun. So we're not really going to be fighting about airplanes and courthouses. College campuses, probably a different calculus. Obviously, the Virginia Tech incident was terrible. It's hard to imagine it would have been any worse if some of those adult law-abiding students and faculty who were licensed by the state to have a gun actually had one available to them.
As you know, though, a lot of people have the opinion that if a lot of people have guns, they inevitably end up getting used in situations of, well, if somebody's extremely angry and they have recourse to a firearm, it's very different than if they don't. And just the presence of more guns in a situation, the university has come to the conclusion that having guns on campus is not a good idea. And they have metal detectors there, too.
If there's some sort of a building where there's extra security that's going on, if there's some sort of special event going on where firearms can be, there's a good reason to eliminate them from the setting, then fine. But the fact of the matter is that more guns do not produce more crime. The statistics actually go in the other direction. And we are not a nation of incipient murderers who suddenly go bonkers simply because we have guns. The fact of the matter is that gun ownership is something that more than 100 million Americans participate in it.
David?
I think one way to think about this is to think of whether a gun is more like a book or a car. A car is a legal product, but it's dangerous. So we all assume that the government can strictly regulate. You have to have a license to drive your car. Your car has to be inspected. There's all kinds of regulations. A book, however, is protected by the First Amendment. And nobody would think that you could regulate and license booksellers, or that you'd have to have your book inspected before you can publish it. And so that's the interesting question, whether they're going to treat this, the Second Amendment, like the First Amendment.
We're talking with David Savage, who covers the Supreme Court for the Los Angeles Times and the Chicago Tribune, and with one of the attorneys who argued before the Supreme Court this morning, Alan Gura, who challenged the Chicago handgun ban. We want to hear where you draw the line. 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. The question before the Supreme Court today, does the Second Amendment limit state and local governments when it comes to regulation of handguns? If it does, is any measure to limit an individual's own right to own a gun constitutional? Where do you draw the line? 800-989-8255 is the phone number. Email us talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation at our website at npr.org. Just click on Talk of the Nation. David Savage is with us. He covers the Supreme Court for the Los Angeles Times and the Chicago Tribune. Also, Alan Gura is with us, the attorney, or one of the attorneys who challenged the Chicago handgun ban and argued before the court this morning. Let's get another caller on the line. Amy's with us from San Jose.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well, thank you.
Good, thanks for taking my call. I just had a brief comment. I'm a federal law enforcement officer. I'm obviously required to carry a firearm. I have one, an issued one, as well as a personal one. I'm required to carry it for work, which includes flying for business, as well as for vacation, based on some new TSA regulations. However, I think when it gets to the point of carrying guns in national parks and state parks, there has to be a line drawn where individuals can feel secure about wondering whether or not the person, you know, sleeping next to them, camping, has a firearm. If, you know, if they hear weird noises at night, are they going to jump out and use that as some kind of protection?
And is well, as a federal agent, obviously you've received a lot of training.
Absolutely, and I think that's a good point. You know, daily I arrest people and see people who have these firearms. They're registered and or unregistered. There's kids around the house. I just recently taught my own children safety and awareness of weapons because it's not brain surgery. It doesn't take much.
All right, Amy, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it.
Thanks.
Alan Gura, what do you think?
Unfortunately, crime is not something that's missing from our national parks, and national parks are typically not very heavily policed. In fact, some of the most popular hiking trails at Oregon Pipe National Park along our border in Arizona are now closed to the public because they've become too dangerous. There are too many people smuggling things across the border, too many drug gangs running rampant. And if you run into trouble somewhere out in the wilderness, you should be able to defend yourself from that source of trouble, just the way that our ancestors did as they settled this continent.
We've been talking about places, also people. Should there be some individuals, convicted felons, for example, people with mental problems, should people, some kinds of people, be prohibited from carrying firearms?
Absolutely. If people are dangerous, if they're mentally unstable or violent, if they're convicted of violent crimes, absolutely. We should prohibit dangerous people from having firearms. Nobody wants to have dangerous people to have guns.
So that implies some sort of licensing process, some sort of permit process.
Not necessarily. I mean, we have a wonderful law in this country whereby if you go to purchase a gun, there will be a background check that's run on you, and the computer will come back after a few minutes and say whether or not you have a record of mental illness or a record of a felony conviction. And if you are, in fact, a disabled person by the law, then you will be denied that transaction. And there's a right to appeal. And sometimes there are problems with typos and
computer
problems.
Could be inaccurate, yeah.
And people do get relief eventually. But there's no need to register people or their guns. And in fact, registration typically does not solve crime.
David Savage, did the question of permits and whether a state or a locality, a city, would be able to license those who carry weapons, did that come up in the arguments today?
Not really. The court basically, I think the members of the majority are inclined to say reasonable regulations are okay, but we're not going to tell you right now what are reasonable regulations. I do think this case would look interesting and different if Allen's plaintiffs are law-abiding Chicagoans who want to have a gun at home for self-defense. I think it's the most sympathetic possible case. But what if they were a guy standing on a street corner with a gun, and they're not criminal? They don't have a criminal record. And they were arrested for having a gun. People might think, well, they look dangerous to me, but they're not criminals. And so if ordinary people had guns on the street and were claiming, I need a gun for self-defense in a bad neighborhood or whatever, that case might look different. And that's the case that somewhere down the road is going to get before the court.
And Alan Gora, we're going to wind up and go to another guest, but do you anticipate those kinds of suits coming up in the future?
Oh, absolutely. Those kinds of suits are coming up, and I know because I'm litigating some of them. The fact of the matter is that you do have a right to carry a gun in public if you are not a dangerous person. Of course, the state can regulate that right under certain circumstances. It simply cannot abolish it altogether. There's only one state in the country that completely prohibits people, all people at all times, from carrying guns under all circumstances. That state is Illinois. And, of course, the Washington, D.C. is following in those unfortunate footsteps. So, of course, the states and localities can regulate the carrying of guns. They can ban dangerous people from doing so. They can cordon off sensitive places. The law, the precedent, even allows them to prescribe the manner of carrying guns, that is, concealed or open. However, a complete ban for all people at all times, for all purposes, is not going to fly.
Alan Gora, thank you very much for your time today.
Thanks.
We appreciate it. Alan Gora is a partner for the firm of Gora and Posesky. I hope I pronounced that correctly, and was kind enough to be with us here in Studio 3A. Joining us now is attorney David Goldberg. He filed an amicus brief in support of Chicago's handgun ban on behalf of several suburban Chicago communities, the Illinois Municipal League, and the International Municipal Lawyers Association. He also teaches at the Supreme Court Litigation Clinic at the University of Virginia Law School and joins us today from our bureau in New York. And thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Now, you're not representing precisely the city of Chicago in this case, but can you give us some insight into their position in this argument?
Well, you're right, Neil, that I'm not representing the city of Chicago, but I represent a group of communities in the Illinois Municipal League, which is an organization of all the cities and towns and municipalities in Illinois. And you framed the question today about where do you draw the line, but we very much think the question in this case is who draws the line. And Alan just said that Illinois is a state that completely bans handguns, but the truth of the matter is that Illinois is a state that allows state localities and communities to make their own decisions, and my clients are very typical. We have one of them is the village of Winnetka, which had a very stringent handgun ban, which was motivated by a very tragic shooting incident in school. I have other members of the organization have a very different view and don't have very limited regulation. And so what we were up there arguing and what the city of Chicago was arguing is that this has historically been a matter for the entire history of the Republic where conditions, local conditions and local values would control where the line is drawn.
The Supreme Court in other kinds of rights cases has in previous years said, yes, states may have had these localities, may have had these rights to do make decisions on these issues in the past. But now we think the federal government has under the 14th Amendment, has the power to do this on all kinds of situations, as David Savage was pointing out, for a long time on First Amendment issues.
Well, that is true, although the Supreme Court has said after the 14th Amendment was ratified that questions the Second Amendment is not one that limited states and localities. So we have a history from 1787 up to the 14th Amendment of this being a matter of local regulation. And then we have a history from 1868 up to the present. There has never been a federal court ruling that has said that states and localities are not free to draw the line. And the reason why that's really important is because this is an area, you've heard from your callers, people have very different views, and they're able to engage in debate and deliberation and experimentation. And I think what the greatest concern here is, and you've already heard from Mr. Gura, that there's going to be everything will now be, the locus of decision-making will now be the federal courts, and federal judges are going to be making gun policy for America, and the range of materials that they have to make those policy decisions are extraordinarily limited and controversial.
If, however, you accept David Savage's analysis that it's likely talking about how and not whether, do you accept his analogy that, you know, are they going to be regulated the way books are regulated or the way that cars are regulated?
Well, I think they obviously, I wasn't present in the courtroom, and it's always very dangerous to make predictions, even if you are in the courtroom, what's going to ultimately happen in the opinion writing process. And oral arguments are often for justices not to so much signal what they're going to do, but probe the advocates. That said, I think it's extraordinarily unlikely, given the country's history and traditions, that there would be anything like a First Amendment regime for guns.
Or that they would be treated the same way as books.
As books, exactly.
So much more a car situation where it's, we're always reminded that a driver's license is a privilege and not a right, so there might be a distinction there. Nevertheless, let's see if we can get some more callers in on the conversation. Bruce is on the line calling from Greenville in North Carolina.
Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Good afternoon.
I feel strongly both ways. I support Attorney Gura's position that carry should be licit in parks, in bars, in libraries, perhaps not in theaters. I've had a permit for in excess of 15 years, and no, I carry it where legal. I've never had the opportunity, bad choice, never had the necessity to ever remove my gun from its carrying place. On the other hand, David Savage's position regarding driver's licenses is entirely appropriate. It should be, yes, it's a right, but it's also a privilege. And the idea that we're not regulating carefully and the national agency check by the feds is not that accurate. I used to do things like that when I was in the intelligence corps. North Carolina requires to get a carry permit, North Carolina requires, among other things, a certificate from your doctor that you're presumably not a lunatic and are a fit person to have such a thing. And the idea that we're allowing people to carry guns, and for that matter even buy guns, without any training is appalling. I've seen people in gun stores come in, they want a handgun for self-protection. The gun guy will sell them something. They don't have any idea how to load it. They don't know what ammunition to buy. They know nothing, and they've got no business possessing a firearm.
So they should be a requirement. Well, again, you can't get a driver's license without passing a driver's test. Presumably
Absolutely.
That needs some training.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, Bruce, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate
Alrighty.
It. And I wondered if we get a response on that from David Goldberg.
Well, you know, I think that is, we think views like that should be heard, you know, in the political process. I think the places that have chosen to regulate firearms do so because they think that they're the right place to draw the line is they require training, they require people to be, they look at background, they worry about safety of children and bystanders. It's not just about incipient murderers. It's also about the safety of children in homes where guns aren't properly stored. And yet other people make the point that more guns means less crime, and that position is heard. And right now in the country, there is, without any Supreme Court or federal court intervention, a lot of recognition and protection for gun rights.
We're talking about the Supreme Court, which heard arguments today about the Second Amendment, specifically with the handgun ban in the city of Chicago and some of its nearby suburbs. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And here's an email from Nicholas in Madison. My problem with gun control legislation is that every law is held to the standard of the Second Amendment. I would like the conversation to be instead, should the Second Amendment be standard? You can debate whether gun bans are effective or not because it takes legal arms out of the system, but not illegal arms. But if you take away the arms from both sides, I don't see how society could benefit. In other words, this is the argument that, I think as the NRA slogan used to put it, if you ban guns, only criminals will have guns. David Savage, I'm sure this comes up. Did this come up today?
Well, my impression is today they wanted to say very little about what the rule is going to be. At one point, John Stevens, who's going to be 90 years old, probably going to retire this spring. He's an exceptionally shrewd guy, and he was trying to find a narrow way to lose this case from his point of view.
Hmm.
And he said, well, what if we just say, why couldn't we say there's a right to have a gun at home, but there's no right to parade on the streets with a gun? And the NRA attorney and the conservative justices scoffed at that point. Stevens was trying to find a way, is there a way to say simply that this right exists, but it's very narrow, it's only at home? The John Roberts and Scalia said they want to leave this open to reasonable regulation down the road, and I really think it's going to take a lot of litigation to try to figure out what's reasonable regulation that's acceptable from their point of view under the Second Amendment.
And yet the Roberts Court has been noted for looking for narrow areas that don't break a lot of new law.
Well, see, that Roberts would think this is an example of that. We're just going to rule narrowly today in this case that the Second Amendment applies to states and localities, and we're not going to tell you anymore. From his point of view, that's sort of a simple, narrow ruling. The difficulty, as David Goldberg and others said, it sends it all out to federal judges. It takes the issue away from states and localities, city councils and whatnot, and it really throws it into federal courts.
David Goldberg, you've talked about that situation arising. This is going to take years to thrash out in courts.
Right, absolutely. I think if you look at what happens, I mean, this would not be a narrow decision for exactly the reason David Savage said, because every case will lead to the next case. Every single gun regulation will be challenged first in federal court, and then it will be taken up to the Court of Appeals and to the Supreme Court. You'll hear, even if Mr. Gura says a regulation he thinks is constitutional, or Justice Scalia in the Heller opinion suggested certain regulations would be constitutional, there are going to be people who are going to still bring challenges and say that violates the Second Amendment. And one of the things as a practical matter is that places like Winnetka, Illinois, just can't afford the costs of litigation and the burden that that's going to impose. And so there's going to be an incredible thumb on the scale, even when people propose what you or I might think is a good idea, or the citizens might think is a good idea, there's going to be an incredible reluctance to go into federal court and spend the next X years defending it.
And the next line, as we heard from Alan Gura, is this the suit that was going to be heard here in Washington, D.C. on concealed carry?
Well, there are suits all over the country, and frankly, there's been some self-restraint, I think, on the gun side because they don't want the court to see such a flood of litigation. They're going to wait and see what happens in this case, and I think you can expect there's going to be massive litigation. The number of state and local regulations that might plausibly be challenged on somebody's most extreme theory of the Second Amendment is limitless.
David Goldberg, thanks very much for your time today. Appreciate it.
Sure. Thank you.
David Goldberg filed an amicus brief on behalf of several suburban Chicago communities and the International Municipal Lawyers Association, and he joined us today from our bureau in New York. David Savage with us here in Studio 3A. David, as always, thanks very much.
Thank you, Neil.
And we'll be expecting you back when the decision comes down, presumably this spring. David Savage covers the Supreme Court for the Los Angeles Times and for the Chicago Tribune. Coming up, the federal government looks for a new way to measure who's poor and who isn't. We'll talk with Undersecretary of Commerce Rebecca Blank. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.